RRI, Public Radio International.
Welcome to Dialogue, a program that explores the world of ideas and issues in national and international affairs, history, and culture. I'm George Liston Cier. Ivan Hannaford devoted much of his life to the study of a problem that vexes modern society like no other, the problem of race and ethnicity. But Ivan Hannaford's vision was unique and his scholarship groundbreaking. He looked past contemporary notions of social engineering to the classic age of Western civilization and societies largely unsullied by racial feeling. He found in them and in the idea of an all-embracing political community the path out of the modern nightmare of racial hatred. Ivan Hannaford passed away earlier this year, but his great work, Race, the History of an Idea in the West, has just been published by the Woodrow Wilson Center Press. And my guest is Joseph Brenly, director of Wilson Center Publications, publisher and friend of Ivan Hannaford. Joe, welcome to Dialogue.
Thank you, George.
Joe, this is truly a major work, and Ivan was a magnificent human being, as we both know. And it seems to me that there's something of a kind of back-to-the-future quality here, that his ideas are rooted in the notion of an ancient Greek civilization where the emphasis was placed on being well-lawed, on political community, as opposed to notions of kinship, of clan, and ultimately, I guess, of physical appearance. Is this the correct notion on my part, a correct starting point for understanding his ideas?
Yes, that's probably the single most important idea in the book, aside from then in turn his discussion of the idea of race itself. But what he looks for and what he finds in places where other people have found race is this notion that in classical civilization they discovered what was for them a new idea, a new way of gathering a community. It had to do with what came to be called politics. Mm-hmm. And the principal idea is that you're in a deliberative community. You're not absolutely united by clan or tribe or anything like that. In fact, in Athens, where this was developed, people retained ritual associations with their own families and clans.
But what unites them is the process of political discussion, of debate. Is that correct, Joe?
Exactly. The idea mm-hmm. is that what forms the political community is the ability to get up and speak clearly, to state interests, to make compromises, and to come out with mm-hmm. a decision which the polis, the city, can pursue.
But as we move, for example, from classic Greek civilization into the age of the Roman Empire, do these ideas persist, this notion of political community as being, again, superior to other kinds of organization, or do we begin to see evidence of racial thinking at that point?
Well, we don't see racial thinking. The ideas persist in a couple of different ways. The classical Greek polis existed only for probably 100 years anyway, in the 3rd century BC. That whole sort of democratic state that we look back to. Democracy, by the way, is to be distinguished from politics,
right.
but they seem to have taken that particular form there. But the notion of the political state certainly persists through the Roman Republic, and is very present in the thought of Cicero, who's relatively practical. He's a practicing lawyer as well as a philosopher. But there's, again, the importance of speaking, of deliberating, of making political decisions in this way, not of living simply according to the will of a tyrant, is strong there. And that even exists during the empire. That's simply the form of political thought.
And this empire,
even though the empire itself becomes a gathering of many different people who are not citizens, most of them. You can have citizens who might be from far off in Gaul or in the Eastern Mediterranean or places like that, but certainly not everyone who lives in the empire is a citizen by a long shot.
Mm-hmm.
And they're citizens of Rome. They're citizens of this city, not of a vast country.
Right.
Kind of interesting.
It is kind of interesting, and it is kind of inclusive, would you not say? I mean, sort of in modern parlance,
yeah.
In this kind of polyglot way.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that Ivan did that I was particularly struck by, and I'd love to get your sense of it and how he went about it, was he didn't rely solely on traditional historical references or even literary sources, but went to things such as depictions in art, numismatic resources, how things appeared on coins. That was my sense of it.
He certainly does some of that sort of work. I think that a lot of that is a follow-on to work that was done by Frank Snowden, who's a very important classicist at Howard University, who was in particular involved in studying coins and the coins, I think, coming from Egypt and so on. And Frank Snowden is really a precursor of Ivan Hannaford in showing the absence of race thinking in the ancient world.
And who were other precursors now that you mentioned Frank Snowden? I got the sense Hannah Arendt, for example, and her thought, and perhaps several other people had influenced Ivan's writings.
Hannah Arendt certainly wrote a very important essay on how race thinking arose. Erich Vogelin is another 20th century figure who was important in that way. Also, the person who contributed a foreword to Ivan's own book, Bernard Crick, and who has been a great supporter of this project, wrote a book in defense of politics, which is a very clear exposition of and an extensive exposition of how politics is different from other ways of organizing a government, tyranny, empire, ideology, the sort of fascist states that we've seen in
Right.
this century, that sort of thing.
I'm glad you mentioned that because we're going to turn to that later in our conversation. Is it the common thesis of the writers you've just mentioned, and of course of Ivan, that in fact, that race as a factor in society is a much later occurrence in human history, that this classical period that we've discussed, just to sort of sum it up, was largely devoid of the kinds of racial and ethnic division and distinction we've made later?
It is, and it's also a lot of Ivan's point is to go back and look through and point by point, case by case, almost grab you by the shirt collar and say, "Look, what are you doing? Why are you applying this notion to of race, this 19th century notion, to these people who had no idea of it?" There's a story that came from somebody who had nothing to do with this project, which is a sort of illustration of this. But the story is that. The fact on which the story is based is that there was a that in China there's a Jewish community that actually arrived there as a result of the diaspora after, in the first century, the destruction of the temple and you have one of these communities of Jews who managed to become very separate from the Western community. And the story goes that in Marco Polo's party, when he traveled from Venice in the 13th century, there one of his companions was a Jew, and he finds out about this community, and he goes and visits, goes to the temple. Everything seems very familiar, and meets the rabbi, just talks for a while, and leaves. And then the story is that as he's walking down the street, the rabbi is looking out the door, turns to one of his usual congregants, and he says, "Well, I don't know. What do you think? He doesn't look Jewish to me." And it's the same sort of thing that we've got here with Ivan. It's grabbing you and saying, "What are you doing? Why are we in 13th century China, having this guy speaking Yiddish, and what's not only speaking Yiddish but having it be a kind of fundamental organizing principle for his world, that these people are biologically not identical, but that sort of defines them."
They're biologically different and therefore defined in that way. Let me take a moment to say that this is Dialogue, a presentation of PRI Public Radio International. I'm George Liston CA, and my guest today is Joseph Brenly, director of Wilson Center Publications. The Wilson Center Press has recently published Race, the History of an Idea in the West by Ivan Hannaford. Joe, mentioning Ivan's name again in connection with the book just makes me very curious about what it was like to work with Ivan on the publication of this book, your contacts with him, the development of the ideas, and the conversations that must have been fascinating that you had with him.
Well, it was really wonderful to work with Ivan. He was, and I think I've mentioned this to you before, he was a great-souled person in a very, very rare sense. And the book itself exposes that in a way. It's a work that he started 30 years ago. He stuck with it. It was an immense accumulation. And then when he was given the opportunity to complete it, he brought it to the Wilson Center where he worked on it. He brought it to another center where he worked on it. He went through not only writing it, but several significant revisions to kind of get 30 years of work down to a point where it's in 400 good pages. And that great souled aspect, that he embodies someone who thinks and speaks, carried through in other ways too. He was warmly regarded when he was here at the center. When I would speak to him, he was back in England by the time we were finishing up the project, but we would speak often in the, somehow it became, we'd speak at 2:30 in the afternoon, which would be, I think, 7:30 where he was. And so he'd be telling me all the news I hadn't seen yet. I heard about the bombing in Oklahoma City first from him. He was shocked. And, you know, I couldn't figure out what he was talking about at first. It was so amazing.
Well, I like your description, great-souled, certainly passionate about this topic, and he seemed to have lived it. And I'm sure we would both agree, a very generous human being as well as an extraordinary mind.
Yes.
Returning to the book that Ivan has left us with, one of the most enchanting chapters in the entire book, Joe, I thought, was the introduction of the word race into Scotland in the mid-14th century. And the curious thing about it, as Ivan documents, is when the word arrives in Scotland at this very pivotal point in our history, it has no connection with the connotations of race we've since developed. It's simply not the same thing.
That's right. It starts out a race like as when we run a race or something like that. It's a course, which is a Latin word for the same thing, from the word to run. And then we apply race to courses of other things, a mill race, of water running down to a mill. As it first becomes applied to human beings, it is applied more in the way that we've seen in Spain, in the sense of bloodlines for the sake of genealogy. It's introduced as a term for a race of kings, a race of bishops, something along those lines. It has nothing to do with dividing up humanity into large groups.
But when it does begin to have something to do with dividing up humanity into groups, I found it ironic that that comes in later, at the time of the Enlightenment, that English philosophers and French rationalists sort of combine their efforts to begin to infuse the word with the kinds of meanings that we have since gone so accustomed to.
Well, it's true. And I think they're thinking about those ideas even before they firmly bring race into the picture. But the ideas that they're thinking about have to do with schemes of biological classification, taking notions of genus and species and robbing them of some of their logical and metaphysical content, which they had in the ancient world, and using them more simply to sort out similar kinds of things.
Right. Is this the point where we began to get the reinterpretations of those classical authors we discussed earlier and the imposition on those authors of racial thinking they didn't necessarily have?
It certainly is, at least in terms of Aristotle's logic of genus and species. Genus and species are used by Aristotle to define the essences of things, or to describe the form of something, which is something inherent in it. It's what's identical between one human being and another for Aristotle, that they are this. It's not simply an accident of their descent that they happen to be human beings caused in some mechanical way. But as we progress into the history of science and so on, we put aside those formal causes and we put aside finality, that these ideas are always underlying somewhere, but science has suppressed them as explicit aims of things. A scientist today would not say that an acorn is trying to grow into an oak tree, whereas Aristotle would be more tolerant of discussing that as the final cause of the acorn. So those things are suppressed, and instead we're left only with matter and with efficient causality.
Yeah.
What makes things go?
As we are proceeding now through the Enlightenment, the 18th century, we'll quickly turn to the 19th century when things really begin to blossom in a sense. Is it correct to think that Ivan is saying the idea of race is ascendant and the idea of political community as the unifying force among people is getting perhaps less emphasis than it had, that this is the period where we begin to see the growth of contrasting notions of what human beings are and how they join and organize?
Well, yes, there are big changes. The notion of politics gets stripped out or suppressed, even starting earlier in the 17th century. The political philosopher Hobbes basically has two principles for organizing people: the right of conquest, and then that given that, people can make deals to do something, but it's all in a sort of context of individuals working things out for themselves, not in the context of a city or a country nowadays pursuing some greater good. The basic notion is that in the state of nature, I have the right to everything, and you have the right to everything, and I can take everything from you, or you can take everything from me, and we're at war with each other constantly. Now, if you start with that kind of individual nature of a human being set loose, and not anymore with the city educating the human being, I mean, if the principle becomes this sort of radical, free thing, then you lose any possibility of a government other than in by sort of nailing it together at the edges.
Mm-hmm. It does seem to me that as this flowers, so to speak, the treatment of history and of human nature becomes a very romantic proposition. And then it's largely German intellectuals of the 18th and 19th century that give that impulse, people like Gotthold Lessing and so forth, that seize upon these notions and begin to speak of the very qualities you've mentioned, this very distinction, emphasizing the individual and what comes to that individual through race and inheritance.
Yeah, it's true. It's perhaps not always right to talk about it in terms of individuals, although I did that myself just now, and I'm not quite sure that's correct. But it is true that it's kind of arising from below. There's a major transition by the very great philosopher Immanuel Kant, who starts talking about the characters of peoples, where the character is something inside, and for him they're not only a character of an individual, but the character of a nation. And it's a self-creating kind of proposition. It's not a proposition where our customs and our ability to live together actually educate the citizen coming along through it. And that sort of notion of character, the notion of self-creating individual, turns into the notion of will, does become very important in Lessing, in the historians of the period, and I'm trying to connect will now in my mind with the folklorists. I think maybe that's a stretch, but it's not a stretch to talk about the folklorists in terms of discovering national character and emphasizing that.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, I don't feel it's any stretch at all. I thought that the notion, as this period develops, is that the folklorists, the use of myth, the emphasis on Volk and the Volkstaat are all part of this progression.
They're certainly allied notions, mm-hmm. and they all reinforce each other.
And they all reinforce racial thinking, and I think what Ivan begins to call at this point quite distinctly, as we now move well into the 19th century, the racialization of history, when many of those writing are looking back and sort of reinterpreting the classical civilizations we began with in ways that are very tendentious and intended to emphasize the racial origins of those states and their racial meaning.
That's certainly true. It's a process that has started with Blumenbach, with whom you began, where instead of looking to Greek political institutions and Roman political institutions, historians and anthropologists look to the Franks, the Saxons, and different groups within the Saxons, whose names I can't remember, Frisians, the Salians, enormous numbers of these groups. Each of them seems to propose some of them as being more virtuous than others. There's this sense of small tribes meeting in the woods. There's a big theme of the woods, which I don't quite follow, but that's the place where virtuous, valorous human beings come together and, you know, follow their rights and...
I think that you're quite right, that, you know, all these romantic notions taking place in their woodland settings, with that's kind of a natural stage for the mythic and the cultic over history, and sort of fits all this very well. I'm wondering this, though, Joe, when we began speaking about Ivan's notion of the ideal of ancient Greek civilization being built upon the political community, the precise word was eunomia, I believe, or that would describe that process. And I'm wondering now, having progressed over these centuries as we have, reaching this period in the late 19th century with this sort of massive misinterpretation of all these sources, have we now entered the age of eugenics? In other words, an age which begins to celebrate the racial ideal, which begins to say that people are what they are by a kind of a racial inheritance, and you can look to groups for qualities that each individual in it will have.
Eugenics really comes along in the late 19th century. There are a couple more elements that need to be added, because it's not only folklorists and it's not only people who are trying to develop notions of racial character or of national character, which can be kept distinct to some extent, but you need scientists in the sense of anthropologists and sociologists, some people who are very famous as statisticians. Pearson, Galton get in on the act, and of course the whole thing gets kicked off by the arrival of Darwin and Herbert Spencer and evolution and natural selection, and maybe not even so much evolution, because if your race is good enough to begin with, you know, what you're really involved in is a war to get rid of the other guys. There's no improvement possible, I suppose. Mm-hmm.
So these become the notions, and it's kind of a collusion, if you will, of literary and intellectual sources and the scientific community reinforcing each other. And between, let's say, 1883 and the outbreak of World War I, really reinforcing this notion of eugenics.
It is, and it's a widely respected field of study. It's a real, in some ways it persists today. There are still journals in existence that whose names have changed since World War II, but were like the Annals of Eugenics and things like that. They're perfectly respected medical journals. The scholarly bodies still exist. And so
is it Ivan's key point, Joe, and this is something that really animates me a great deal, that a lot of our Western thought, our modern day contemporary Western thought about notions of race, really gets stuck in this period, perhaps not as crudely as it might have been presented between 1883 and 1914, but certainly persistently, notions of races being distinct and different have origin in that the thought of that time, a thought which still influences a lot of the way society operates.
Well, it is, that is a key point. Let me backtrack a little bit, because what we're doing is we're running between 1914 to 1996 without a stop in between. Of course, the huge thing in between is the Holocaust, which points out, you know, makes abundantly clear how insane a lot of this stuff is. But in other ways, it continues today as an undercurrent. After World War, actually right around the time of the Second World War, people started looking at what was then called the Negro question in the United States, and and these are people who are not racists in any conventional sense. They are not like the eugenicists. They certainly don't want to exterminate anybody. They don't even want to keep anybody down. They would become supporters of the civil rights movement and so on, but they still have an ability to allow people to sort themselves out on this basis. They think that's a stable condition of history, that we can't really change that.
That's the way things are.
That's the way things are. Mm-hmm. And they also don't really believe in, I think this is a big theme of Ivan's toward the end of the book, they don't really believe in politics as a way of dealing among different groups. Mm-hmm. Instead, what they propose different schemes for social engineering, where you're going to, in effect, try to use bad ways that people organize themselves in order to cause racial progress.
Joe, I want to conclude our conversation by bringing us right into the here and now. And you've already taken us across several eons and centuries, so I'm pretty sure you can deal with today. But the obvious here and now question for Americans, and I have a sense that Ivan was particularly interested in this society in terms of our own racial history and racial dilemma. The question might be this: did Ivan Hannaford think, again in terms of America with its organization, that we could sort of willy-nilly or quickly abandon notions of ethnicity, of race, of group, and so forth that we have developed so rigorously over 200 years and essentially become a kind of a libertarian society solely focused on the political community that we could just set these things aside, or is it more complex, or do we have to work through where we are right now?
At one point when early on in editing the book, I was worried precisely about that, because obviously this book is hell-bent against the notion that race has any real meaning that we should attend to. And I was afraid that what Ivan was setting himself up to do was to be the sort of neoconservative poster boy of 1996. And whether you like that way of thinking or not, it didn't fit with the way I reacted to Ivan, so I phoned him up and asked him about it. And he said, "Oh, Joe, that would be like getting a telegram saying Archduke Ferdinand found alive. World War I, a mistake." There are interests, and the groups that have been constituted as racial groups are going to continue to have interests, and the important point is for them to be able to articulate them in public to encourage that, so that we can come to a decision, and that decision won't be permanent. There will be another decision. You know, this deliberative process goes on, and the decision making goes on. What's important is that there's a sort of good pursued through it all, and that we all agree that ultimately there's a sort of unanimity. This is a point that comes out of someone else called Yves Simon, but ultimately politics provides unanimity. Not that you and I agree absolutely what's best, but that we're unanimous in agreeing that we will agree on what to do.
Right. And I think that's a very valuable lesson and a very, very, very valuable gift that Ivan Hanifer's left us in this book, Joe. Joe Brindley, thank you so much for being with us on Dialogue today. Again, the book is Race, the History of an Idea in the West. It's published by the Wilson Center Press. And how is it available, Joe?
I'm glad you asked that, George. This book is co-published by the Wilson Center Press and the Johns Hopkins University Press. Mm-hmm. And the Johns Hopkins University Press serves as distributor for the book. And it is probably in larger bookstores in the country, if not, am I allowed to give an order number?
Certainly.
An 800 number? Yeah, Johns Hopkins has an 800 number, which is 800-537-5487. Mm-hmm. For a mnemonic, it's 537-JHUP.
Well, I hope many people call that number, because it's a marvelous book and a great contribution. Thank you, Joe Brindley.
Well, thank you, George.
You have been listening to Dialogue. My guest today was Joseph Brindley, director of Wilson Center Publications. I'm George Liston C.A., producer and host of Dialogue. Assistant producer is Dennis Saunier, and our technical director is John Tyler. Dialogue is presented by PRI, Public Radio International, and is a production of the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars in association with Radio Smithsonian. Established by Congress in 1968, the center is our nation's official and living memorial to the 28th President of the United States, Woodrow Wilson.
For cassettes or more information on Dialogue, call us at 303-823-8000. Contact us on America Online at Radio Dial. That's RADIODIAL at AOL.com. Visit our internet webpage at wwics.si.edu.